the South are not due to urban violence or things like robberies, but are instead about affronts to honor between people who know each other. And it helps explain why Southern prosecutors and juries are typically more forgiving of such crimes of affronted honor. And it also helps explain the command apparently given by many Southern matriarchs to their sons marching off to join the Confederate fight: come back a winner or come back in a coffin. The shame of surrender is not an option. Shamed collectivists and guilty individualists. We return to our contrast between collectivist and individualistic cultures. In the studies, as a reminder, collectivist has mostly meant East Asian societies, while individualistic equals Western Europeans and North Americans. Implicit in the very nature of the contrast are markedly different approaches to the morality of ends and means. By definition, collectivist cultures are more comfortable than individualistic ones with people being used as a means to a utilitarian end. Moreover, moral imperatives in collectivist cultures tend to be about social roles and duties to the group, whereas those in individualistic cultures are typically about individual rights. Collectivist and individualistic cultures also differ in how moral behavior is enforced. As first emphasized by the anthropologist Ruth Benedict in 1946, collectivist cultures enforce with shame, while individualistic cultures use guilt. This is a doozy of a contrast, as explored in two excellent books, Stanford psychiatrist Herant Kachaturian's Guilt, The Bite of Conscience, and NYU environmental scientist Jennifer Jacquet's Is Shame Necessary? In the sense used by most in the field, including these authors, shame is external judgment by the group, while guilt is internal judgment of yourself. Shame requires an audience, is about honor. Guilt is for cultures that treasure privacy and is about conscience. Shame is a negative assessment of the entire individual. Guilt, that of an act, making it possible to hate the sin but love the sinner. Effective shaming requires a conformist, homogeneous population. Effective guilt requires respect for law. Feeling shame is about wanting to hide. Feeling guilt is about wanting to make amends. Shame is when everyone says, you can no longer live with us. Guilt is when you say, how am I going to live with myself? Footnote. Just to bring another term into the mix, most in the field seem to categorize embarrassment as a transient, low-rent version of shame. Its regulatory power is shown by the Semai people of the Malay Peninsula, who say, there is no authority here but embarrassment. From the time that Benedict first articulated this contrast, there has been a self-congratulatory view in the West that shame is somehow more primitive than guilt, as the West has left behind dunce caps, public flogging, and scarlet letters. Shame is the mob. Guilt is internalizing rules, laws, edicts, decrees, and statutes. Yet, Jacquet convincingly argues for the continued usefulness of shaming in the West, calling for its rebirth in a postmodernist form. For her, shaming is particularly useful when the powerful show no evidence of feeling guilt and evade punishment. We have no shortage of examples of such evasion in the American legal system, where one can benefit from the best defense that money or power can buy. Shaming can often step into that vacuum. Consider a 1999 scandal at UCLA, when more than a dozen healthy, strapping football players were discovered to have used connections, made up disabilities, and forged doctor signatures to get handicapped parking permits. Their privileged positions resulted in what was generally seen as slaps on the wrist by both the courts and UCLA. However, the element of shaming may well have made up for it. As they left the courthouse in front of the press, they walked past a phalanx of disabled, wheelchair-bound individuals, jeering them. Anthropologists, studying everyone from hunter-gatherers to urbanites, have found that about two-thirds of everyday conversation is gossip, with the vast majority of it being negative. As has been said, gossip, with the goal of shaming, is a weapon of the weak against the powerful. It has always been fast and cheap, and is infinitely more so now in the era of the scarlet internet. Shaming is also effective when dealing with outrages by corporations. Bizarrely, the American legal system considers a corporation to be an individual in many ways, one that is psychopathic in the sense of having no conscience and being solely interested in profits. The people running a corporation are occasionally criminally responsible when the corporation has done something illegal. However, they are not when the corporation does something legal, yet immoral. It is outside the realm of guilt. Jacquet emphasizes the potential power of shaming campaigns, such as those that forced Nike to change its policies about the horrific working conditions in its overseas sweatshops, or paper giant Kimberly-Clark to address the cutting of old-growth forests. Amid the potential good that can come from such shaming, Jacquet also emphasizes the dangers of contemporary shaming, which is the savagery with which people can be attacked online and the distance such venom can travel. In a world where getting to anonymously hate the sinner seems more important than anything about the sin itself. Fools Rush In, Applying the Findings of the Science of Morality. How can the insights we already have in hand be used to foster the best of our behaviors and lessen the worst? Which dead white male was right? Let's start with a question that has kept folks busy for millennia. Namely, what is the optimal moral philosophy? People pondering this question have grouped the different approaches into three broad categories. Say there's money sitting there, and it's not yours, but no one is looking. Why not grab it? Virtue ethics, with its emphasis on the actor, would answer, because you are a better person than that, because you'll have to live with yourself afterward, etc. Deontology, with its emphasis on the act, because it's not okay to steal. Consequentialism, with its emphasis on the outcome, what if everyone started acting that way? Think about the impact on the person whose money you've stolen, etc. Virtue ethics has generally taken a back seat to the other two in recent years, having acquired a quaint veneer of antiquarian fretting over how an improper act tarnishes one's soul. As we'll see, I think that virtue ethics returns through the back door with considerable relevance. By focusing on deontology versus consequentialism, we are back on the familiar ground of whether ends justify means. For deontologists, the answer is no, people can never be pawns. For the consequentialist, the answer is yes, for the right outcome. Consequentialism comes in a number of stripes, taken seriously to varying degrees, depending on its features. For example, yes, the end justifies the mean if the end is to maximize my pleasure, hedonism, to maximize overall levels of wealth, to strengthen the powers that be, state consequentialism. For most, though, consequentialism is about classical utilitarianism. It is okay to use people as a means to the end of maximizing overall levels of happiness. When deontologism and consequentialism contemplate trolleys, the former is about moral intuitions rooted in the VMPFC, amygdala, and insula, while the latter is the domain of the DLPFC and moral reasoning. Why is it that our automatic, intuitive moral judgments tend to be non-utilitarian? Because, as Green states in his book, our moral brains evolved to help us spread our genes, not to maximize our collective happiness. The trolley studies show people's moral heterogeneity. In them, approximately 30% of subjects were consistently deontologists, unwilling to either pull a lever or push a person, even at the cost of those five lives. Another 30% were always utilitarian, willing to pull or push. And for everyone else, moral philosophies were context-dependent. The fact that a plurality of people fall into this category prompts Green's dual process model, stating that we are usually a mixture of valuing means and ends. What's your moral philosophy? If harm to the person who is the means is unintentional, or if the intentionality is really convoluted and indirect, I'm utilitarian consequentialist. And if the intentionality is right in front of my nose, I'm a deontologist. The different trolley scenarios reveal what circumstances push us toward intuitive deontology, which toward utilitarian reasoning. Which outcome is better? For the sort of person reading this book, i.e. who reads and thinks, things to be justifiably self-congratulatory about. When considering this issue at a calm distance, utilitarianism seems like the place to start, maximizing collective happiness. There is the emphasis on equity, not equal treatment, but taking everyone's well-being into equal consideration. And there is the paramount emphasis on impartiality. If someone thinks the situation being proposed is morally equitable, they should be willing to flip a coin to determine which role they play. Utilitarianism can be critiqued on practical grounds. It's hard to find a common currency of people's differing versions of happiness. The emphasis on ends over means requires that you be good at predicting what the actual ends will be. And true impartiality is damn hard with our us-them minds. But in theory, at least, there is a solid, logical appeal to utilitarianism. Except that there's a problem. Unless someone is missing their VMPFC, the appeal of utilitarianism inevitably comes to a screeching halt at some point. For most people, it's pushing the person in front of the trolley. Or smothering a crying baby to save a group of people hiding from Nazis. Or killing a healthy person to harvest his organs and save 5 lives. As Green emphasizes, virtually everyone immediately grasps the logic and appeal of utilitarianism, yet eventually hits a point where it is clear that it's not a good guide for everyday moral decision-making. Green and, independently, the neuroscientist John Ullman of Caltech and historian of science James Woodward of the University of Pittsburgh have explored the neurobiological underpinnings of a key point. The utilitarianism being considered here is unidimensional and artificial. It hobbles the sophistication of both our moral intuitions and our moral reasoning. A pretty convincing case can be made for utilitarian consequentialism, as long as you consider the immediate consequences, and the longer-term consequences, and the long-long-term consequences, and then go and consider them all over again a few times. When people hit a wall with utilitarianism, it's because what is on paper a palatable trade-off in the short run, intentionally kill one to save 5 that obviously increases collective happiness, turns out not to be so in the long run. Sure, that healthy person's involuntary organ donation just saved 5 lives. But who else is going to get dissected that way? What if they come for me? I kinda like my liver. What else might they start doing? Slippery slopes, desensitization, unintended consequences, intended consequences. When short-sighted utilitarianism, what Woodward and Ullman call parametric consequentialism, is replaced with a longer-viewed version, what they call strategic consequentialism, and what Green calls pragmatic utilitarianism, you get better outcomes. Our overview of moral intuition versus moral reasoning has generated a dichotomy, something akin to how guys can't have lots of blood flow to their crotch and their brain at the same time. They have to choose. Similarly, you have to choose whether your moral decision-making will be about the amygdala or the DLPFC. But this is a false dichotomy because we reach our best long-term, strategic, consequentialist decisions when we engage both our reasoning and our intuition. Sure, being willing to do X in order to accomplish Y seems like a good trade-off in the short run. But in the long run, if we do that often enough, doing Z is going to start to seem okay also. And I'd feel awful if Z were done to me. And there's also a good chance that W would happen, and that's going to generate really bad feelings in people, which will result in... And the feel part of that process is not the way Mr. Spock would do it, logically and dispassionately remembering that those humans are irrational, flighty creatures, and incorporating that into his rational thinking about them. Instead, this is feeling what the feelings would feel like. This is straight out of Chapter 2's overview of Damasio's somatic marker hypothesis. When we are making decisions, we are running not only thought experiments, but somatic feeling experiments as well. How is it going to feel if this happens? And this combination is the goal in moral decision-making. Thus, no way I'd push someone onto the trolley tracks, it's just wrong, is about the amygdala, insula, and VMPFC. Sacrifice one life to save 5? Sure, is the DLPFC. but do long-term strategic consequentialism? And all those regions are engaged. And this yields something more powerful than the cocksureness of knee-jerk intuitionism, the, I can't tell you why, but this is simply wrong. When you've engaged all those brain systems, when you've done the thought experiments and feeling experiments of how things might play out in the long run, and when you've prioritized the inputs, gut reactions are taken seriously, but they're sure not given veto power, you'll know exactly why something seems right or wrong. The synergistic advantages of combining reasoning with intuition raise an important point. If you're a fan of moral intuitions, you'd frame them as being foundational and primordial. If you don't like them, you'd present them as simplistic, reflexive, and primitive. But as emphasized by Woodward and Allman, our moral intuitions are neither primordial nor reflexively primitive. They are the end products of learning. They are cognitive conclusions to which we have been exposed so often that they have become automatic, as implicit as riding a bicycle or reciting the days of the week forward rather than backward. In the West, we nearly all have strong moral intuitions about the wrongness of slavery, child labor, or animal cruelty. But that sure didn't used to be the case. Their wrongness has become an implicit moral intuition, a gut instinct concerning moral truth only because of the fierce moral reasoning and activism of those who came before us, when the average person's moral intuitions were unrecognizably different. Our guts learn their intuitions. Slow and fast. The separate problems of me versus us and us versus them. The contrast between rapid, automatic moral intuitionism and conscious, deliberative moral reasoning plays out in another crucial realm and is the subject of Green's superb 2014 book, Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Green starts with the classic tragedy of the commons. Shepherds bring their flocks to a common grazing field. There are so many sheep that there is the danger of destroying the commons unless people decrease the size of their herds. And the tragedy is that if it is truly a commons, there is no incentive to ever cooperate. You'd range from being a fool if no one else was cooperating to being a successful free rider if everyone else was. This issue, namely how to jumpstart and then maintain cooperation in a sea of non-cooperators, ran through all of Chapter 10, and, as shown in the widespread existence of social species that cooperate, this is solvable. Stay tuned for more in the final chapter. When framed in the context of morality, averting the tragedy of the commons requires getting people in groups to not be selfish. It is an issue of me versus us. But Green outlines a second type of tragedy. Now, there are two different groups of shepherds, and the challenge is that each group has a different approach to grazing. One, for example, treats the pasture as a classic commons, while the other believes that the pasture should be divided up into parcels of land belonging to individual shepherds with high, strong fences in between. In other words, mutually contradictory views about using the pasture. The thing that fuels the danger and tragedy of the situation is that each group has such a tightly reasoned structure in their heads as to why their way is correct that it can acquire moral weight, be seen as a right. Green dissects that word brilliantly. For each side, perceiving themselves as having a right to do things their way mostly means that they have slathered enough post hoc Haitian rationalizations on a shapeless, self-serving, parochial moral intuition, have lined up enough of their gray-bearded philosopher king shepherds to proclaim the moral force of their stance, feel in the most sincere, pained way that the very essence of what they value and who they are is at stake, that the very moral rightness of the universe is wobbling, all of that so strongly that they can't recognize the right for what it is. Namely, I can't tell you why, but this is how things should be done. To cite a quote attributed to Oscar Wilde, morality is simply the attitude we adopt towards people whom we personally dislike. It's us versus them framed morally, and the importance of what Green calls the tragedy of common sense morality is shown by the fact that most intergroup conflicts on our planet ultimately are cultural disagreements about whose right is righter. This is an intellectualized, bloodless way of framing the issue. Here's a different way. Say I decide that it would be a good thing to insert pictures here demonstrating cultural relativism, displaying an act that is commonsensical in one culture but deeply distressing in another. I know, I think, I'll get some pictures of a Southeast Asian dog meat market. Like me, most readers will likely resonate with dogs. Good plan. On to Google Images, and the result is that I spend hours transfixed, unable to stop, torturing myself with picture after picture of dogs being carted off to market, dogs being butchered, cooked, and sold, pictures of humans going about their day's work in a market, indifferent to a crate stuffed to the top with suffering dogs. I imagine the fear those dogs feel, how they are hot, thirsty, in pain. I think, what if these dogs had come to trust humans? I think of their fear and confusion. I think, what if one of the dogs whom I've loved had to experience that? What if this happened to a dog my children loved? And with my heart racing, I realize that I hate these people, hate every last one of them, and despise their culture. And it takes a locomotive's worth of effort for me to admit that I can't justify that hatred and contempt, that mine is a mere moral intuition, that there are things that I do that would evoke the same response in some distant person whose humanity and morality are certainly no less than mine, and that but for the randomness of where I happen to have been born, I could have readily had their views instead. The thing that makes the tragedy of common sense morality so tragic is the intensity with which you just know that they are deeply wrong. In general, our morally tinged cultural institutions, religion, nationalism, ethnic pride, team spirit, bias us toward our best behaviors when we are single shepherds facing a potential tragedy of the commons. They make us less selfish in me versus us situations, but they send us hurtling toward our worst behaviors when confronting thems and their different moralities. The dual process nature of moral decision-making gives some insights into how to avert these two very different types of tragedies. In the context of me versus us, our moral intuitions are shared, and emphasizing them hums with the pro-sociality of our usness. This was shown in a study by Green, David Brand of Yale, and colleagues, where subjects played a one-shot public goods game that modeled the tragedy of the commons. Subjects were given differing lengths of time to decide how much money they would contribute to a common pot, versus keeping it for themselves to everyone else's detriment. And the faster the decision required, the more cooperative people were. Ditto if you had primed subjects to value intuition by having them relate a time when intuition led them to a good decision or where careful reasoning did the opposite, more cooperation. Conversely, instruct subjects to carefully consider their decision or prime them to value reflection over intuition and they'd be more selfish. The more time to think, the more time to do a version of, yes, we all agree that cooperation is a good thing, but here is why I should be exempt this time. What the authors called calculated greed. What would happen if subjects played the game with someone screamingly different to human as you could find, by whatever the subject's standards of comfort and familiarity? While the study hasn't been done, and would obviously be hard to do, you'd predict that fast, intuitive decisions would overwhelmingly be in the direction of easy, unconflicted selfishness, with them, xenophobia alarms ringing, and automatic beliefs of don't trust them instantly triggered. When facing me versus us moral dilemmas of resisting selfishness, our rapid intuitions are good, honed by evolutionary selection for cooperation in a sea of green beard markers. And in such settings, regulating and formalizing the pro-sociality, i.e. moving it from the realm of intuition to that of cogitation, can even be counterproductive, a point emphasized by Samuel Bowles. In contrast, when doing moral decision-making during us-versus-them scenarios, keep intuitions as far away as possible. Instead, think, reason, and question. Be deeply pragmatic and strategically utilitarian. Take their perspective, try to think what they think, try to feel what they feel. Take a deep breath, and then do it all again. Veracity and mendacity. The question rang out, clear and insistent, a question that could not be ignored or evaded. Chris swallowed once, tried for a voice that was calm and steady, and answered, "No, absolutely not." It was a bald-faced lie. Is this a good thing or bad thing? Well, it depends on what the question was. A. When the CEO gave you the summary, were you aware that the numbers had been manipulated to hide the third quarter losses? Asked the prosecutor. B. Is this a toy you already have? Asked Grandma tentatively. C. What did the doctor say? Is it fatal? D. Does this outfit make me look... E. Did you eat the brownies that were for tonight? F. Harrison, are you harboring the runaway slave named Jack? G. Something's not adding up. Are you lying about being at work late last night? H. OMG, did you just cut one? Nothing better typifies the extent to which the meanings of our behaviors are context-dependent. Same untruth, same concentration on controlling your facial expression, same attempt to make just the right amount of eye contact. And depending on the circumstance, this could be us at our best or worst. On the converse side of context dependency, sometimes being honest is the harder thing. Telling an unpleasant truth about another person activates the medial PFC, along with the insula. Given these complexities, it is no surprise that the biology of honesty and duplicity is very muddy. As we saw in Chapter 10, the very nature of competitive evolutionary games selects for both deception and vigilance against it. We even saw proto-versions of both in social yeast. Dogs attempt to deceive one another, with marginal success. When a dog is terrified, fear pheromones emanate from his anal scent glands, and it's not great if the guy you're facing off against knows you're scared. A dog can't consciously choose to be deceptive by not synthesizing and secreting those pheromones, but he can try to squelch their dissemination by putting a lid on those glands, by putting his tail between his legs. "I'm not scared, no siree," squeaked Sparky. No surprise, non-human primate duplicity takes things to a whole other level. If there is a good piece of food and a higher-ranking animal nearby, capuchins will give predator alarm calls to distract the other individual. If it is a lower-ranking animal, no need, just take the food. Similarly, if a low-ranking capuchin knows where food has been hidden and there is a dominant animal around, he will move away from the hiding place. If it's a subordinate animal, no problem. The same is seen in spider monkeys and macaques. And other primates don't just carry out tactical concealment about food. When a male gelada baboon mates with a female, he typically gives a copulation call, unless he is with a female who has snuck away from her nearby consortship male, in which case he doesn't make a sound. And, of course, all these examples pale in comparison with what politico chimps can be up to. Reflecting deception as a task requiring lots of social expertise across primate species, a larger neocortex predicts higher rates of deception, independent of group size. Footnote. Just to reiterate, starting with those social yeast, deception is not limited to primates. Deception along similar lines to that observed in capuchins has been reported in those brilliant corvid birds. Moreover, behavior such as plover birds feigning injury to lure a predator away from its nest have been interpreted as tactical deception. Don't eat the babies. Look, come after me. I've got more meat and I can't get away because I'm injured. Similar deception has also been reported in other birds, some ungulates and cuttlefish. That's impressive, but it is highly unlikely that there is conscious strategizing on the part of these primates. or that they feel bad or even morally soiled about being deceptive, or that they actually believe their lies. For those things, we need humans. The human capacity for deception is enormous. We have the most complex innervation of facial muscles and use massive numbers of motor neurons to control them. No other species can be poker-faced. And we have language, that extraordinary means of manipulating the distance between a message and its meaning. Humans also excel at lying because our cognitive skills allow us to do something beyond the means of any perfidious gelada baboon. We can finesse the truth. A cool study shows our propensity for this. To simplify, a subject would roll a die, with different results yielding different monetary rewards. The rolls were made in private, with the subject reporting the outcome, an opportunity to cheat. Given chance and enough rolls, if everyone was honest, each number would be reported about 1/6 of the time. If everyone always lied for maximal gain, all rolls would supposedly have produced the highest paying number. There was lots of lying. Subjects were over 2,500 college students from 23 countries, and higher rates of corruption, tax evasion, and political fraud in a subject's country predicted higher rates of lying. This is no surprise after Chapter 9's demonstration that high rates of rule violations in a community decrease social capital, which then fuels individual antisocial behavior. What was most interesting was that across all the cultures, lying was of a particular type. Subjects actually rolled a die twice, and only the first roll counted. The second, they were told, tested whether the die was working properly. The lying showed a pattern that, based on prior work, could be explained by only one thing. People rarely made up a high-paying number. Instead, they simply reported the higher roll of the two. You can practically hear the rationalizing. Darn, my first roll was a one, a bad outcome. My second, a four. Better. Hey, rolls are random. It could just as readily have been a four as a one, so let's just say I rolled a four. That's not really cheating. In other words, lying most often included rationalizing that made it feel less dishonest. Not going whole hog for that filthy lucre so that your actions feel like only slightly malodorous untruthiness. When we are lying, naturally, regions involved in theory of mind are involved, particularly with circumstances of strategic social deception. Moreover, the DLPFC and related frontal regions are central to a neural circuit of deception. And then, insight grinds to a halt. Back to the theme introduced in Chapter 2 of the frontal cortex, and the DLPFC in particular, getting you to do the harder thing when it's the right thing to do. And in our value-free sense of right, you'd expect the DLPFC to activate when you're struggling to do A, the morally right thing, which is to avoid the temptation to lie, as well as B, the strategically right thing, namely, once having decided to lie, doing it effectively. It can be hard to deceive effectively, having to think strategically, carefully remembering what lie you're actually saying, and create a false affect. Your Majesty, I bring terrible, sad news about your son, the heir to the throne. Yeah, we ambushed him. High fives! Thus, activation of the DLPFC will reflect both the struggle to resist temptation and the executive effort to wallow effectively in the temptation once you've lost that struggle. Don't do it, plus, if you're going to do it right. This confusion arises in neuroimaging studies of compulsive liars. What might one expect? These are people who habitually fail to resist the temptation of lying. I bet they have atrophy of something frontocortical. These are people who habitually lie and are good at it, and typically have high verbal IQs. I bet they have expansion of something frontocortical. And the studies bear out both predictions. Compulsive liars have increased amounts of white matter, i.e. the axonal cables connecting neurons in the frontal cortex, but lesser amounts of gray matter, i.e. the cell bodies of the neurons. It's not possible to know if there's causality in these neuroimaging/behavior correlates. All one can conclude is that the frontocortical regions, like the DLPFC, show multiple and varied versions of doing the harder thing. You can dissociate the frontal task of resisting temptation from the frontal task of lying effectively by taking morality out of the equation. This is done in studies where people are told to lie. For example, subjects are given a series of pictures. Later, they are shown an array of pictures, some of which are identical to ones in their possession, and asked, "Is this a picture you have?" A signal from the computer indicates whether the subject should answer honestly or lie. In this sort of scenario, lying is most consistently associated with activation of the DLPFC, along with the nearby and related ventrolateral PFC. This is a picture of the DLPFC going about the difficult task of lying effectively, minus worrying about the fate of its neuronal soul. The studies tend to show activation of the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, as well. As introduced in Chapter 2, the ACC responds to circumstances of conflicting choices. This occurs for conflict in an emotional sense, as well as in a cognitive sense, e.g., having to choose between two answers when both seem to work. In the lying studies, the ACC isn't activating because of moral conflict about lying, since subjects were instructed to lie. Instead, it's monitoring the conflict between reality and what you've been instructed to report. And this gums up the work slightly. People show minutely longer response times during lying trials than during honest ones. This delay is useful in polygraph tests, i.e., lie detectors. In the classic form, the test detected arousal of the sympathetic nervous system, indicating that someone was lying and anxious about not getting caught. The trouble is that you'd get the same anxious arousal if you're telling the truth, but your life's over if that fallible machine says otherwise. Moreover, sociopaths are undetectable, since they don't get anxiously aroused when lying. Plus, subjects can take countermeasures to manipulate their sympathetic nervous system. As a result, this use of polygraphs is no longer admissible in courts. Contemporary polygraph techniques instead home in on that slight delay, on the physiological indices of that ACC conflict, not the moral one, since some miscreant may have no moral misgivings, but the cognitive conflict. Yeah, I robbed the store, but no, wait, I have to say that I didn't. Unless you thoroughly believe your lie, there's likely to be that slight delay, reflecting the ACC-ish cognitive conflict between reality and your claim. Thus, activation of the ACC, DLPFC, and nearby frontal regions is associated with lying on command. At this point, we have our usual issue of causality. Is activation of, say, the DLPFC a cause, a consequence, or a mere correlate of lying? To answer this, transcranial direct current stimulation has been used to inactivate the DLPFC in people during instructed lying tasks. Result? Subjects were slower and less successful in lying, implying a causal role for the DLPFC. And to remind us of how complicated the issue is, people with damage to the DLPFC are less likely to take honesty into account when honesty and self-interest are pitted against each other in an economic game. So this most egg-heady, cognitive part of the PFC is central to both resisting lying and, once having decided to lie, doing it well. This book's focus is not really how good a liar someone is. It's whether we lie, whether we do the harder thing and resist the temptation to deceive. For more understanding of that, we turn to a pair of thoroughly cool neuroimaging studies where subjects who lied did so not because they were instructed to, but because they were dirty, rotten cheaters. The first was carried out by the Swiss scientists Thomas Baumgartner, Ernst Fehr, whose work has been noted previously, and colleagues. Subjects played an economic trust game where, in each round, you could be cooperative or selfish. Beforehand, a subject would tell the other player what their strategy would be. Always, slash, sometimes, slash, never cooperate. In other words, they made a promise. Some subjects who promised to always cooperate broke their promise at least once. At such times, there was activation of the DLPFC, the ACC, and, of course, the amygdala. Footnote. The amygdaloid involvement is probably pertinent to a case report from some French neurologists concerning a man who had a seizure every time he lied during business negotiations. He was found to have a tumor pressing on his amygdala. Once it was removed, the seizures went away. There was no mention of whether the guy was still lying at work. The authors called this Pinocchio syndrome. A pattern of brain activation before each round's decision predicted breaking of a promise. Fascinatingly, along with predictable activation of the ACC, there'd be activation of the insula. Does the scoundrel think, I'm disgusted with myself, but I'm going to break my promise? Or is it, I don't like this guy because of X. In fact, he's kind of disgusting. I owe him nothing. I'm breaking my promise. While it's impossible to tell, given our tendency to rationalize our own transgressions, I'd bet it's the latter. The second study comes from Green and colleague Joseph Paxton. Subjects in a scanner would predict the outcome of coin tosses, earning money for correct guesses. The study's design contained an extra layer of distracting nonsense. Subjects were told the study was about paranormal mental abilities, and for some of the coin tosses, for this concocted reason, rather than state their prediction beforehand, subjects would just think about their choice and then tell afterward if they were right. In other words, amid a financial incentive to guess correctly, there were intermittent opportunities to cheat. Crucially, this was detectable. During the periods of forced honesty, subjects averaged a 50% success rate. And if accuracy jumped a lot higher during opportunities to cheat, subjects were probably cheating. The results were pretty depressing. Using this form of statistical detection, about a third of the subjects appeared to be big-time cheaters, with another sixth on the statistical border. When cheaters cheated, there was activation of the DLPFC, as we'd expect. Were they struggling with the combination of moral and cognitive conflict? Not particularly. There wasn't activation of the ACC, nor was there the slight lag time in response. Cheaters typically didn't cheat at every opportunity. What did things look like when they resisted? Here's where you saw the struggling. Even greater activation of the DLPFC, along with the VLPFC, the ACC roaring into action, and a significant delay in response time. In other words, for people capable of cheating, the occasional resistance seems to be the outcome of major neurobiological Sturm und Drang. And now for probably the most important finding in this chapter. What about subjects who never cheated? There are two very different scenarios as framed by Green and Paxton. Is resisting temptation at every turn an outcome of will, of having a stoked DLPFC putting Satan into a hammerlock of submission? Or is it an act of grace, where there's no struggle because it's simple? You don't cheat. It was grace. In those who are always honest, the DLPFC, VLPFC, and ACC were in veritable comas when the chance to cheat arose. There's no conflict. There's no working hard to do the right thing. You simply don't cheat. Resisting temptation is as implicit as walking upstairs, or thinking Wednesday after hearing Monday, Tuesday, or as that first piece of regulation we mastered way back when, being potty trained. As we saw in Chapter 7, it's not a function of what Kohlbergian stage you're at. It's what moral imperatives have been hammered into you with such urgency and consistency that doing the right thing has virtually become a spinal reflex. This is not to suggest that honesty, even impeccable honesty that resists all temptation, can only be the outcome of implicit automaticity. We can think and struggle and employ cognitive control to produce similar stainless records, as shown in some subsequent work. But in circumstances like the Green and Paxton study, with repeated opportunities to cheat in rapid succession, it's not going to be a case of successfully arm-wrestling the devil over and over. Instead, automaticity is required. We've seen something equivalent with the brave act. The person who, amid the paralyzed crowd, runs into the burning building to save the child. What were you thinking when you decided to go into the house? Were you thinking about the evolution of cooperation, of reciprocal altruism, of game theory and reputation? And the answer is always, I wasn't thinking anything. Before I knew it, I had run in. Interviews of Carnegie Medal recipients about that moment shows precisely that. A first, intuitive thought of needing to help, resulting in the risking of life without a second thought. Heroism feels and never reasons, to quote Emerson. It's the same thing here. Why did you never cheat? Is it because of your ability to see the long-term consequences of cheating becoming normalized? Or your respect for the golden rule? Or... The answer is, I don't know, shrug. I just don't cheat. This isn't a deontological or a consequentialist moment. It's virtue ethics sneaking in the back door in that moment. I don't cheat. That's not who I am. Doing the right thing is the easier thing. Chapter 14. Feeling someone's pain, understanding someone's pain, alleviating someone's pain. A person is in pain, frightened, or crushed with a malignant sadness, and another human, knowing that, is likely to experience something absolutely remarkable, an aversive state that is approximated by the word empathy. As we'll see in this chapter, it is a state on a continuum with what occurs in a baby or in other species. The state takes varied forms, with varied underlying biology, reflecting its sensory-motor, emotional, and cognitive building blocks. Various logical influences sharpen or dull the state, all leading to this chapter's two key questions. When does empathy lead us to actually do something helpful? When we do act, whose benefit is it for? For versus as if and other distinctions. Empathy, sympathy, compassion, mimicry, emotional contagion, sensory-motor contagion, perspective-taking, concern, pity. Let the terminology and squabbles begin over definitions of ways in which we resonate with someone else's adversity, along with the question of whether the opposite of such resonance is gloating pleasure or indifference. We start with, for want of a better word, primitive versions of resonating with someone's pain. There's sensory-motor contagion. You see a hand poked with a needle, and the part of your sensory cortex that maps onto your hand activates, sensitizing you to the imagined sensation. Perhaps your motor cortex will also activate, causing you to compress your own hand. Or you watch a tightrope walker and involuntarily put your arms out for balance. Or someone has a coughing fit and your throat constricts. Even more explicitly motoric is the act of matching movements with simple mimicry. Or there's emotional contagion, the automatic transfer of strong emotive states, such as one baby crying because another is, or someone catching the fever of a mob plunging into a riot. Your resonance with someone's plight can carry an implicit power differential. You can pity someone in pain, recalling Fiske's categories of thems in Chapter 11. This belittling pity means you view the person as high in warmth and low in competence and agency. And we all know the everyday meaning of sympathy. Look, I sympathize with your situation, but... You have the power to alleviate their distress, but choose not to. Then there are terms reflecting how much your resonance is about emotion versus cognition. In that sense, sympathy means you feel sorry for someone else's pain without understanding it. In contrast, empathy contains the cognitive component of understanding the cause of someone's pain, taking his perspective, walking in his shoes. And then there are distinctions introduced in Chapter 6, describing how much you and your own feelings play into resonating with someone else's distress. There's the emotionally distanced sense of sympathy, of feeling for someone. There's the raw, vicarious state of feeling their pain as if it were happening to you. And then there is the more cognitively distanced state of perspective taking, of imagining what this must be like for her, not you. As we'll see, an as-if state carries the danger that you experience her pain so intensely that your primary concern becomes alleviating your own distress. Which raises a different word, compassion, where your resonance with someone's distress leads you to actually help. Perhaps most important, these words are generally about inwardly motivated states. You can't force someone to truly feel empathy, can't induce it in them with guilt or a sense of obligation. You can generate ersatz versions of it those ways, but not the real thing. Consistent with that, some recent work shows that when you help someone out of empathy, there is a very different profile of brain activation from when you do so out of an obliged sense of reciprocity. As usual, we gain insights into the nature and biology of these states by looking at their rudiments in other species, their development in children, and their pathological manifestations. Emotionally contagious, compassionate animals. Lots of animals display building blocks of empathic states. I use empathic state throughout the chapter when referring to the collectivity of sympathy, empathy, compassion, etc. There's mimicry, a cornerstone of social learning in many species. Think young chimps watching mom to learn to use tools. Ironically, humans' strong proclivity for imitation can have a downside. In one study, chimps and children observed an adult human repeatedly accessing a treat inside a puzzle box. Crucially, the person added various extraneous movements. When exploring the box themselves afterward, chimps imitated only the steps needed to open it, whereas kids over-imitated, copying the superfluous gestures as well. Footnote. Or stated another way, the chimps were less susceptible to superstitious behavior than were the humans. Social animals are also constantly buffeted with emotional contagion. Shared states of arousal in a pack of dogs or male chimps going on a border patrol. These are not terribly precise states, often spilling over into other behaviors. For example, say some baboons flush out something good to eat, say a young gazelle. The gazelle is running like hell with these baboons in pursuit. And then the male in front seems to think something along the lines of, well, here I am running fast and what? There's my hated rival running right behind me. Why is that jerk chasing me? He spins around for a head-on collision and fight with the baboon behind him, gazelle forgotten. Mimicry and emotional contagion are baby steps. Do other animals feel one another's pain? Sort of. Mice can learn a specific fear association vicariously by observing another mouse experiencing the fear conditioning. Moreover, this is a social process. Learning is enhanced if the mice are related or have mated. In another study, a mouse would be exposed to an aggressive intruder placed in its cage. As shown previously, this produces persistent adverse consequences. A month later, such mice still had elevated glucocorticoid levels and were more anxious and more vulnerable to a mouse model of depression. Importantly, the same persistent effects would be induced in a mouse merely observing another mouse experiencing that stressful intruder paradigm. An even more striking demonstration of your pain is my pain in another species came in a 2006 science paper from Jeff Mogul of McGill University. A mouse would observe another mouse, separated from it by plexiglass, in pain, and, as a result, its own pain sensitivity increased. In another part of the study, an irritant would be injected in a mouse's paw. Mice typically lick their paw at that point, with the amount of licking indicating the amount of discomfort. Thus, X amount of the irritant would produce Z amount of licking. However, if the mouse was simultaneously observing a mouse who had been exposed to more than X amount of irritant, and who thus was licking more than Z amount, the subject mouse would lick more than usual. Conversely, if the subject observed a mouse licking less, having been exposed to less than X amount of irritant, it would also lick less. Thus, the amount of pain a mouse was feeling was modulated by the amount of pain a nearby mouse was. Importantly, this was a social phenomenon. This shared pain only occurred between mice that were cage mates. Obviously, we can't know the internal state of these animals. Were they feeling bad for the other mouse in pain, feeling for, or as if, taking the other mouse's perspective? Pretty unlikely, making the use of the word empathy in this literature controversial. However, we can observe overt behavior. Do other species proactively lessen the distress of another individual? Yes. As we will see in the final chapter, numerous species show reconciliative behavior, where two individuals, soon after a negative interaction, show higher than chance levels of affiliative behaviors, grooming, sitting in contact between them, and this decreases the odds of subsequent tensions between them. As shown by Duval and colleagues, chimps also show third-party consolation behavior. This is not when, after two individuals fight, some bleeding-heart chimp indiscriminately nices both of them. Instead, the consoler is preferentially affiliative to the victim over the initiator of the fight. This reflects both a cognitive component of tracking who started attention and an affective desire to comfort. Similar consolation, focused on fight victims, also occurs in wolves, dogs, elephants, and corvids who preen the feathers of victims. Ditto for bonobos, with some bonobo-esque sex thrown in for victims along with all that platonic grooming. In contrast, such consolation doesn't occur in monkeys. Consolation is also shown among those heartwarming pair-bonding prairie voles, as shown in a 2016 Nature paper from Larry Young of Emory University, a pioneer of the vole-slash-monogamy-slash-vasopressin story, along with Duval. Members of a vole pair would be placed in separate rooms. One of the pair would be either stressed, with a mild shock, or left undisturbed. Pairs were then reunited. As compared with unstressed individuals, stressed ones would be licked and groomed more by their partner. Partners would also match the anxiety behaviors and glucocorticoid levels of their stressed pairmate. This didn't occur for a stressed stranger, nor among polygamous meadow voles. As we'll see, the neurobiology of this effect is all about oxytocin and the anterior cingulate cortex. Animals will intervene even more proactively. In one study, rats worked more, pressing a lever, to lower a distressed rat dangling in the air in a harness than a suspended block. In another study, rats proactively worked to release a cage mate from a stressful restrainer. Subjects were as motivated to do this as to get chocolate, nirvana for rats. Moreover, when a rat could both release the cage mate and get chocolate, they'd share it more than half the time. This pro-sociality had an us-them component. The authors subsequently showed that rats would work to release even a strange rat, so long as it was of the same strain and thus nearly genetically identical. Is this automatic us-theming built on the genetics of shared pheromone signatures? Back to chapter 10. No. If a rat is housed with a cage mate of another strain, it will help individuals of that other strain. And if a rat is switched at birth and raised by a female of another strain, it helps members of its adopted but not its biological strain. Us is malleable by experience, even among rodents. Why do all these animals labor away consoling another individual in distress or even helping them? It's probably not conscious application of the golden rule, and it's not necessarily for the social benefits. Rats were just as likely to release cage mates from restrainers, even if they didn't get to interact afterward. Maybe it's something resembling compassion. On the other hand, maybe it's just self-interest. That dangling rat's incessant alarm calls are getting on my nerves. I'm going to work to lower him so he'll shut up. Scratch an altruistic rat, and a hypocrite bleeds. Emotionally contagious, compassionate children. A recap of material covered in chapters 6 and 7. As we saw, a developmental landmark is attaining theory of mind, something necessary but not sufficient for empathy, which paves the way for increasing abstraction. The capacity for simple sensory motor contagion matures into empathic states for someone's physical pain and, later, for someone's emotional pain. There's the progression from feeling sorry for an individual, e.g. someone homeless, to feeling sorry for a category, e.g., homeless people. There is increasing cognitive sophistication, as kids first distinguish between harming an object and harming a person. Likewise for distinguishing between intentional and unintentional harm, along with a capacity for moral indignation that is more readily evoked by the former. Along with this comes a capacity to express empathy and a sense of responsibility to act upon it, to be proactively compassionate. Perspective taking matures as well, as the child transitions from solely being capable of feeling for to also feeling as if. As we saw, the neurobiology of this developmental arc makes sense. at the age where an empathic state is evoked only by someone's physical pain, brain activation centers on the periaqueductal gray, PAG, a fairly low-level way station in the brain's pain circuitry. Once emotional pain can evoke an empathic state, the profile is mostly about coupled activation between the emotional, the MPFC, and limbic structures. As the capacity for moral indignation matures, coupling among the VMPFC, the insula, and amygdala emerges. And as perspective taking comes into play, the VMPFC is increasingly coupled to regions associated with theory of mind, like the temporoparietal junction. This was our picture of empathic states in kids being built upon the cognitive foundation of theory of mind and perspective taking. But as we also saw, there are empathic states earlier on, infants showing emotional contagion, a toddler trying to comfort a crying adult by offering her stuffy, long before textbook theory of mind occurs. And just as with empathic states in other animals, one must ask whether compassion in kids is mostly about ending the sufferer's distress or ending their own. Affect and or cognition. This again. We can predict the major punchlines, thanks to the previous three chapters. Both cognitive and affective components contribute to healthy empathic states. It's silly to debate which is more important. What's interesting is seeing when one predominates over the other. Even more interesting is to look at the neurobiology of how those components interact. The affective side of things. When it comes to empathy, all neurobiological roads pass through the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC. As introduced in Chapter 2, this frontal cortical structure has starred in empathy neuroscience ever since people felt someone else's pain while inside a brain scanner. Given its more traditional roles in mammals, the ACC's empathy connection is unexpected. Broadly, those roles are processing interoceptive information. As introduced in Chapter 3, our brains monitor sensory information not only from outside us, but from our internal world as well. Interoceptive information about achy muscles, dry mouths, bowels in an uproar. If you unconsciously sense that your heart is racing, and that makes you experience some emotion more intensely, thank the ACC. The ACC funnels literal gut feelings into intuitions, and metaphorical gut feelings influencing frontal function. Pain is a key type of interoceptive information that catches the ACC's attention. Conflict monitoring. The ACC responds to conflict in the sense of a discrepancy from what is expected. If you associate doing some behavior with a particular outcome, when that outcome doesn't occur, the ACC takes notice. This monitoring of discrepancy from expectation is asymmetrical. Do some task that pays 2 brownie points, and today, unexpectedly, you get 3 instead, and the ACC perks up and takes notice. Do the task, and instead of 2 brownie points, you only get 1, and the ACC activates like mad. In the words of Kevin Ochsner of Columbia University and colleagues, the ACC is an all-purpose alarm that signals when ongoing behavior has hit a snag. Unexpected pain is at the intersection of those two roles of the ACC, a sure sign that things are amiss with your schema about the world. Even with anticipated pain, you monitor whether it turns out to be of the quality and quantity expected. As noted, the ACC doesn't concern itself with pedestrian concerns about pain. Is it my finger or my toe that hurts? That's the purview of less refined, more ancient brain circuitry. What the ACC cares about is the meaning of the pain. Good news or bad, and of what nature? Thus the ACC's perception of pain can be manipulated. Poke your finger with a pin, and the ACC activates, along with those brain regions telling you which finger and what parameters of pain. Make someone believe that the inert cream you just smeared on his finger is a powerful painkiller, and when you poke his finger, the "it's my finger, not my toe" circuitry still activates. But the ACC falls for the placebo effect and stays silent. Obviously, the ACC receives inputs from interoceptive and exteroceptive outposts. Equally logically, it sends lots of projections into the sensory motor cortex, making you very aware of and focused on the body part that hurts. But the sophistication of the ACC, the reason it sits up there in the frontal cortex, is apparent when considering another type of pain. Back to Chapter 6 and the cyberball game, where subjects and brain scanners play catch with a virtual ball on a computer screen, tossing it back and forth, and the other two players stop throwing the ball to you. You're being left out, and the ACC activates. Insofar as the ACC cares about the meaning of pain, it's just as concerned with the abstractions of social and emotional pain, social exclusion, anxiety, disgust, embarrassment, as with physical pain. Intriguingly, major depression is associated with various abnormalities in the ACC. And the ACC is also involved during positive resonance, when their pleasure is your pleasure. All this makes the ACC sound pretty self-oriented, mighty concerned with your well-being, which makes its empathy role initially surprising. Nonetheless, numerous studies consistently show that if someone else's pain, a poked finger, a sad face, a tale of misfortune, is evoking an empathic state in you, the ACC is involved. Moreover, the more painful the other person's situation seems